is Joanne, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really grateful to be here, and I'm really grateful to be sober. I brought the chocolate cake tonight. Because I just wanted to read an excerpt from the book. It's on page 134. It begins at the top of the page. Should constantly have chocolate available. For its quick energy value at times of fatigue. He added that occasionally in the night a vague craving arose which could only be satisfied by candy. Many of us have noticed a tendency to eat sweets and have found this practice beneficial. So,
you'll make amends to the OAs later.
This is Alcoholics Anonymous. My sober date is May 11th, 1994. I just like spaced it there for a second. And for that, I am extremely grateful. I know that I was separated from alcohol for the last time that day. As long as I continue to practice the principles in this program and do as I'm told, the promises, and for me it's been fulfilled to this date, much to my complete joy, that I will never feel the need to take a drink again. I talked briefly in the previous weeks about how I know I'm an alcoholic. And it kind of boils down to two simple things. At the beginning of the chapter, We Agnostics, it asks two simple questions. And one of them is, if when drinking you find you have little control over the amount you take. And for me, that was pretty true. And looking back over my drinking career, as I like to call it, there were many times when I thought I had control, but I didn't. And for me, that was the crux of the matter. I thought I just drank because I liked it. I thought I drank because I got that really great get up and go, got to go out there, got to love the world, got the world by the tail kind of feeling from booze. And I thought everybody got that. It was when people started saying to me things like, you really ought to slow down, what are you doing, what's going on with you, maybe you should, you know, knock it off for a while, that I started realizing that other people in this world weren't having the same experience with booze that I was. I love booze. And that's why I thought I drank so much. The other thing was, in The Agnostics, it asks another question, and it says, when you want to stop, you find you can't stay stopped, essentially is the question. And for me, I found that that was pretty true, too. Even though I would, swear off when I had a really bad hangover, it usually wouldn't last more than a week at a time. Even though there was a period of time when I was working full-time and I was going to school full-time and I was changing careers, that I didn't drink for a period of about 6 months. Immediately, on picking up the bottle one more time and having a drink, of course I bought myself a quart of vodka, I didn't go and buy a bottle of wine or something, I knew from my own personal history what it would take to get to where I wanted to go that night. And even though I hadn't had a drink in 6 months, I knew I deserved it, because I had, completed this course. I had secured a job in my new career, and I was actively working in that career. And I knew that I deserved that drink. So I went out and I bought myself a bottle of vodka and proceeded to drink the whole thing. I got real worried when I came out of the brownout that I had gone into midway through the bottle, and realized there was only about an inch or two left in the bottom, because I didn't really know what time it was when I came out of that blackout, and I wasn't sure if the liquor stores were still open, because I knew I was going to need some more, because I had come out of the blackout. Basically, the only two things that ever were successfully could, you know, separate me from alcohol were unconsciousness or threat of arrest, you know, or actual arrest. I knew enough, you know, when I was out at a bar, generally, I knew enough to stop in, you know, so that I was relatively, you know, okay to drive home, you know. There were times that the police thought differently when they pulled me over. You know, these kinds of things lead us into the rooms, lucky for us. It's when, you know, we get those kinds of rude awakenings that we realize that, yeah, you know, there really might be something going on here. You know, I don't really think the problem is alcohol, but, you know, I'm really not happy, so maybe I ought to start talking to somebody about something. And that's what happened for me. So even though I was able to stop for brief periods of time, I always went back. And when I did go back, I always drank out of control. Well, not always drank out of control. Another question that I often ask people, because I, when I start to work with them, because I found it very enlightening for myself, was could I control and enjoy my drinking? No. I could control it, or I could enjoy it. You know? I couldn't do both. You know, so those are really basically the questions for me that brought me to the fact that I am an alcoholic. Now, what was I going to do about that? In step two, I was given essentially the answer. You know, our book talks about there is a solution, and the solution really for us as alcoholics is a spiritual one. We heal spiritually from the inside and then on to the outside, you know, and then mentally and then physically. I didn't quite get that. Because, you know, I was in a rehab and I had been separated from alcohol for a brief period of time. Now, I was severely addicted to alcohol when I came into the rooms or when I went to that rehab. I shook for a period of several months afterwards to the point where I wouldn't get a cup of coffee in a meeting because my pride wouldn't let me let you see me shake and possibly spill it. So for me, I thought that I needed to heal physically. But what happened was, the program Alcoholics Anonymous started to work on me on the insides. And as it started to work on me on my insides, I started to realize that as I started to heal on the inside, the stuff on the outside wasn't so bad after all. Amazing, you know? It's just amazing, you know? After doing step two, what happened for me with step two was I had to really get over my prejudices against my concept of God. Our book, our program, uses the word God for higher power. For me, I call God God because that's what he is. I was, you know, I was raised with that name, you know, much like I would call, you know, Sarah, Sarah, and Mike, Mike. I mean, they're their given names, and for me, God's name is God, so that's that. And but today, what I believe about God, I can't describe it to you. If I tried to describe it to you, it would just limit it. But I can tell you that it's not the concept I had when I was 4, and it's definitely not the concept I had when I was 12, and it's definitely not the concept I had when I was 20, and it's definitely not the concept I had when I was 37 and a half before I got here. Because, you know, at that point, I really thought that God was doing all this just to spite me, you know? Because, you know, John spoke so eloquently earlier about, you know, doing our resentments lists and talking about our grudges. And I had this, like, tremendous grudge against God because I thought, you know, he was punishing me with this sickness that I had, you know. And I knew I was sick. I knew when I got here, I really just felt like I had lost my soul. And that's exactly where I was. And that was my realization, you know, that the beginning of this, and the promise for me that this was an inside job, that it was gonna, that I was gonna heal on the inside out, that's where it really, really was important to me, that promise, you know, that I could heal on the inside, because I couldn't figure out what happened. Where did I go? Where was I? I couldn't find me anymore, you know? I knew all these things that I was trying to be and that I was trying to look like and I was trying to act like and I was trying to perform up to, you know, in the business world, but I just didn't know where I was anymore. And that's one of the wonderful benefits of this program is that's what I'm starting to find, you know? And I'll say I'm starting to find because one of the great things about this is that it gets better all the time, you know? I keep finding out more and more, and I keep coming, you know? It's a great reason to keep coming, you know, because there's still more for me here. You know, I keep finding that out. Even when I get into little parts, you know, where, you know, I know, you know, a lot of people talk about this, you know, and we go through leaps and bounds in our recovery, and especially, you know, like the fifth step is like a giant, huge shot. It's like, for me, that was like the hugest God shot, you know, of all. And I just wanted to read, because these are really important promises for me. And on page 75, it talks about the step five benefits. One of the reasons that I like to point these out when I work with women is because one of the statements that really struck me in the beginning was somebody said, you know, you can't scare an alcoholic with hell because we've already been there and we're back, you know. So, you know, to put that a little bit more mildly, you know, as I work through the steps, personally, one of the things that I have to remember is that I can't keep my eye on, you know, what's going to happen to me if I don't, because that stuff doesn't really scare me. But you know what I like to keep my eye on? I like to keep my eye on what will happen if I do. You know why? Because it's true. You know, the stuff that they say is going to happen for you, it really does. You know, and I was like shocked when it started to happen because I didn't even know, like half the time, I didn't even know that that was part of what everybody else, happened for everybody else, because they didn't necessarily tell you, you know, all the stuff that happened. So these things that happened after I did my fifth step were just so important for me. And it says, once we have taken this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. Oh, that was so true for me. We can look the world in the eye. Now, that was the first time I could do that in a really long time, you know. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. And I talked quite a bit about this last week because this one for me was the first one that I could really physically feel. Being able to sit alone in my apartment without the radio on, without the stereo on, without the computer on, without the TV on, not talking on the telephone, you know, not having that feeling like I got to rush out and run and find something to do with myself, you know, because there's always something better where I'm not. You know, I'm never, and to be alone at perfect peace and ease and just to be okay in me. Oh man, that was big. You know, our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. Like, it's like happening for me now. You know, I heard all you talking about it, but now it was happening for me, to me, in me. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And I also felt like I was finally really truly a part of this thing, this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. You know, like I was finally starting to, you know, get in the swing, you know, once I had done my fifth step. So that's kind of a brief review. As far as 6, 7, 8, and 9, one of the things that I find really, really important in step 4, because step 4 really kind of lays the groundwork. It, for me, it lays the groundwork and it kind of prepares me for everything else. Because that's the beginning of me actually, you know, writing stuff down, looking at it truthfully, with God at my side, you know, and this is my new found concept of God. And the only thing I can say is, you know, and you can think of it however you want to, but if you could just think of what it would be like, what the best friend you could ever have would be like, you know, like if you can use that, if you're looking for what you need to think of as God, that worked for me in the beginning, and it still works for me, you know, because as I grow and as I learn and as I become more open to people, that concept for me continues to grow also. So, you know, with this friend, with a capital F, at my side, I found that there's a couple of things that happen between the third column and the fourth column. Because in our instruction book, this little blue book called Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about after you've done the third column and you've looked at, you know, who these people are, institutions, principles, what they did, and how it affected me, now we begin to look at the other side of the coin. And in preparation for that, one of the things we do is we pray for those people, mostly, and we try to forgive them. Now, sometimes this is a long process, you know, and one of the things that I have found when I'm doing inventory is that I really don't see the truth in the next column as far as what my part is in it until I can forgive, okay? One of my favorite speakers is Marianne Williamson, A Course in Miracles, and one of the things she says is, you know, we gotta forgive them, but that doesn't mean we have to do lunch. Okay? So if you can keep that in mind, you know, just because you forgive them doesn't mean that you have to get to a point where, you know, you want to be best friends again necessarily, okay? But that's where we're at this point in the inventory. And so for me, that's a really important part of this process, is actually doing that work, which has to be done between the writing here. There's a lot of work that has to be done. And it may take a long time for me to come to terms with the fact that, you know, I have to forgive that person for all this stuff they did to me. And how dare they? And so that I can clearly see what my part was. And then, of course, in the fourth column, we do finally see our part, what I had done, what was the true nature. And usually for me, a lot of it has to do with what I either did or what I expected or what I wanted to happen and how I tried to get that to happen. And those are like kind of the things that I have to look at in that fourth column. Because generally, you know, I will do anything I can to try to manipulate any situation to achieve what my goal is in that situation. You know, I'm pretty goal-oriented person. And there's, you know, generally, I kind of know how I think things ought to turn out. You know. What would be best? So those are the kind of things that I actually do write down, okay? So what happens is the praying and the forgiving, really, between the third column, after you do the third column, that prayer that happens, and the instructions for it are in like the two or three pages that follow that little grid in the book. There's a couple of paragraphs to talk about, you know, all the things that we need to think about and the prayers we can use to achieve that. That really is our preparation for steps 8 and 9 and becoming willing to make the amend. Because we're never going to be willing to make an amend to a person until we forgive them. And that forgiveness actually happens after we write that third column, or else we're not going to see the fourth column clearly. And then what we need to look at and what we want to change for 6 and 7 comes from what we write in the fourth column. That's what I find happens for me. When I do inventory, I find that after completing the fifth step and talking it over with my sponsor, it's really important for me to immediately come to terms. You know, it's suggested in the book that we take 1 hour, and that's like the only time in the instructions that it actually tells you to take any space of rest, I think, at all. Otherwise, it usually says immediately, now, without delay, you know, things like that. I don't think it ever says anything like, wait another year. Give yourself some time to justify it all again. you know, which is what my mind will do with it, you know. So it's important for me, after that hour, you know, to then go and to immediately become willing to have these causes, conditions, these wrongs, these the nature of my wrongs, all of my character defects removed. And our program suggests that, you know, being filled with all these character defects, we obviously can't rid ourselves of them. We don't have the power to do it. So it suggests that we merely say a prayer and ask God to do it. If we do this with a truly open heart, we can be immediately white as snow. Okay? And that'll last for about a minute. Because, you know, then my sponsor will be like, well, I got to go because, you know, I got to walk the dog, you know, and my husband's been waiting for me. And I'm like, oh, you know. But there was still some stuff I wanted to talk about, you know, like I didn't get to talk about myself for 2 days already. So, anyway, so what I need to do at this point is, and I forgot to bring something with me. I don't think I have one in. Do you have one of those little cards with you, Michael? Oh, Mike and Bill had made up these little cards. And basically on one side were all the character defects that are listed in the, in the big book and 12 and 12. Here it is. It's in my big book, my big, big book, the big print big book. And I used this little card. Mike has about 5,000 of them. See him later.
Bill
has about 5,000 of them. Mike can get a hold of them. and basically, it was suggested at one of the big book studies these guys did that you know, in our daily meditation in the morning, if we can, you know, just read through this card, because one of the things that I do in the morning is I start and I read the big book from, I think it's page 84, where it says this step brings us to step 10, and I read that through page 88 as a morning meditation in prayer form, you know, like where it says, you know, like we want the vision of God's will into all our activities. I'll say, dear God, please give me the vision of your will in all of my activities. Like, I'll say all of it as a prayer, and I'll, like, where it ever says ask, I'll say, please God. And it was also suggested that, you know, where there's certain places where it says, you know, we, you know, try not to be self-seeking or dishonest, you know, and it goes through those kind of characteristics. I use this card and I say, dear God, please help me to be, and I read what's written on this card, which are the opposite of the character defects. And the character defects are all of the character defects that are specifically noted in the big book, or the 12 and 12, I'm pretty sure. And I'll just say, you know, dear God, please help me to be more interested in others, help me to be more honest, help me to have courage and faith. And I pray for all of these good things, because I've been taught that nature abhors a vacuum. And any time that I ask for something to be removed, something will come in its place. Now, that's why I pray for these good things. I pray, and it also helps to remind me that these are the things that I want to be during the day. You know, as it says in our fear inventory, it talks about, you know, we pray for God to show us what he'd like us to be. And so I pray for God to show me to be these things. And it helps me to, if I start my day with these. And then sometimes during the day, like I have one of these, you know, in my car, and I'll just you know, just read it, you know, like when I'm like really having a bad, like if I just had like an interchange with somebody that I just feel a little bit of ick about, you know, I talk to you guys about the ick, you know, and sometimes, you know, you just feel a little icky inside after you have an interchange with somebody, and I don't really know if it was them or it was me or it's just the way I'm reacting to it or whatever, and I'll read the card and I try to pray, you know, that I'll have compassion towards other people, that I can be loving and tolerant, you know, even if I don't agree with them. One of the things that they did like a whole lecture on this when I was in rehab, and it was about, you know, the other fella's right to be wrong, you know, like I don't have to make him right, like because I'm right, you know, I don't have to make him agree with me, you know, he's got a right to be wrong, you know, let him be wrong. So that's one of the things that, you know, I have to remember, you know, and it's really hard for me to remember these things, you know, because it's real easy for me to slip back into my old behaviors, and I don't want to. Because I really didn't, you know, like, I love doing amends, I loved the effect afterwards, but I hate the before part. So if I can avoid that, you know, on any given day, that's a good day, you know. So that's pretty much how I deal with 6 and 7. It's pretty simple and it's pretty straightforward. And I really like that John talked about the absolutes. One of the things that I've been taught, and I'll talk about this next week also, is, you know, in prayer and meditation and looking at my thoughts and what my plans are for the day and testing it against the four absolutes to see how they stack up against absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute love, absolute unselfishness, absolute faith. You know, because if there's something that I don't want to do, it's usually, you know, and I feel like I should do it, it's generally because I'm fearful, because I have lack of faith, or because I'm just thinking about myself and I think I know better, you know. And that's usually what it means when there's something that really is the right thing to do, but for some reason I just don't want to do it, you know. So I have to look at that too. In 8 and 9, naturally, you know, we have to become willing to go and make these amends. And how do you know when you're willing? You know, I've heard it said that, you know, you're willing when you find yourself knocking on the door, you know. To actually go to the appointment you made after you made the phone call. you know, it's like, you know, the whole way, you know, it's like it's so easy for us to balk, you know. And, you know, once again, I have to go back to, you know, what I said earlier. And, you know, the reason why that came up for me this week in meditation was because I was thinking about, you know, what was I going to say about amends? And I really have to look at what the benefits are. And I can't look at, you know, what might happen to me if I don't, you know. I've heard of, like, sponsors that'll, you know, come and they'll, like, slam a bottle of bourbon in front of you and say, you know, either make this amend or drink this, you know, and that kind of stuff. And you know what? I'm not going to drink it, and I'm not going to make the amend either, so there. You know? You know? Nobody could really make me do anything, you know? Yeah, certainly not a sponsor, you know? And I'm very fortunate because I think my sponsor knew that. So she's always been a carrot person rather than a stick person, you know? you know, she'll lure me with the benefits rather than scaring me with the punishment, you know, because, you know, the punishment's just, you know, they've done that, you know, I survived. You can't hurt me, you know. It's just like, you know, that's not going to break down my walls, because you know what, these walls are strong, they're tough, they've been here for a long time, and I paid a lot of money for them at that liquor store. So, you know, it's just not going to scare me, you know. Punishment doesn't scare me, but, you know, what does work, though, is seeing the benefits, you know. And for me, you know, I can tell you some stories about some of my amends. There were a couple. Well, let's see. We could start with when I first got out of rehab, I did my first fourth and fifth step for a quick review when I was in rehab the last time. I did six and seven, and I came out doing my amends. I was 22, 23 days sober at that point. I wasn't real good at it. You know? But hey. You know, practice makes perfect, right? I've had a little practice since then. You know? I don't know if it gets all that much easier, but, you know. You know, now I've got, like, this whole method, you know, like, you know, I write up this card, and I write the name at the top, and I write the phone number, and I have to write a plus or a minus, am I willing or not? I mean, you know, there's all these instructions, you know, it depends on what you want to do, but the fact of the matter is, you just got to do it, you know, however you do it, you just got to do it, and the things you got to remember is, are you there because you genuinely, in your heart, want to set the situation right? Because really, let me see here. What's it saying? I don't have this book here. It says, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, not whenever, except to do when to do so would injure them or others. Now, it doesn't say if it's going to injure me that I shouldn't do it. You know, I've heard that quite often. I'll start with, let's see. Well, there was this guy. Okay, we'll start with my ex-employer. His name was Bob. This man spent the better part of 2 years of his life chasing me around, following me around, writing down everything I did because I was working for a major health insurance company in New Jersey. And they had a very corporate, very unionized shop where everything had to be documented before you could get rid of anybody. Okay, now I was in the habit of going out to lunch. And I had a group of people that I would go out with. You know, it was like one of those deals where, you know, I would walk in the door and, you know, like at 12:05 and my drink was on the bar before I was at the bar, you know. So, anyway, so this poor man who is very talented, who was on his way up in the corporate structure, had to spend 2 years of his life documenting my antics. You know, what a waste. You know what I mean? What a waste of good talent, you know? And, you know, after I got out of rehab, I was probably, I don't know, a week or two sober, and I gave him a call. And I had gotten fired from this job, by the way. by the way. Because when I went back into rehab for the second time, what had happened while I was gone was that there had been an outsourcing to another major company, a major information systems company. And they had outsourced my whole department, and they ended up letting one-third of the staff go. Now, I know why they let me go. You know, a lot of people did get the shift, and I feel bad for them, but I do feel that in my case they were quite justified. And this man retained his job, and he was concerned about me. He cared about me. You know, he really did. You know, and he wished the best for me. And when I went to make amends with him, I went over to his house and you know, because I called him on the phone and I said, I'd like to speak with you. And I called him and I got his home phone number. I called him at home and I made an appointment to go and see him. And we went out and we, you know, got some lunch and went back to his home, and he had a beautiful home. And we sat and we talked. And he was really very kind and very gentle. And, you know, I just expressed with him, you know, how much I regretted the fact that, you know, he had to do all this stuff, because he certainly didn't want to do it. He certainly didn't need to do it, and he certainly didn't deserve to have to do all this stuff that he had to do, and it was all because of what I was doing, and, you know, the way the corporations are structured, that's what had to be done, you know, because they knew that they had to figure out the way to best document the case so I didn't come back and sue them, you know. So So I did the best I could to, you know, to talk with him that day, and he basically, you know, said, well, there's nothing that you need to do, you know, to set this situation right. I really just wish you well, you know. And for me, that was really quite a blessing. You know, the fact that I was able to see that, you know, what he had done for me really was the hand of God, you know, and I need to see that in all my affairs is how the hand of God works for me, and to be grateful for it, regardless of how I might feel about it at the moment or how I might think the situation should be. You know, it really was the hand of God, because that's when I got sober, you know. And another person that I immediately began to make amends to was my ex-husband. Well, he was my husband then. I was still married to him. This one was really hard for me to say. He and I were the best drinking partners I had ever. He was the best drinking partner I had ever had. We drank really well together. That was, you know, the one thing we did really well together. The fact of the matter is, however, that he was very abusive, verbally and physically. And although he had started to get sober, at least 2 years chronologically prior to this day in May, when I went back into rehab, he never could quite get it. He went in and out and in and out and in and out of rehab after rehab after rehab, because I had really good insurance. He wasn't working. And so, you know, I had to begin to forgive him for what he had done to me, but at the same time, realize that the situation wasn't going to get any better the way it was. One of the first things that I did for him was to get a restraining order. He was in, when I went into rehab, he went into a rehab, and he was supposed to be in there. It's a long-term rehab where you're supposed to stay there at least, like you sign this paper that you're supposed to stay for at least 90 days. And his counselor talked to my counselor, and they found out that as soon as I had left my rehab, he was, like, planning his escape. So one of the first things that I did for him, even though I didn't speak to him, and this was at the beginning of my amend to him, was to finally get a restraining order so that he knew that he couldn't come back to my house and continue what he had been doing. He needed to stay where he was so he could begin to get better. To my knowledge, today he is sober. After he got out of the rehab, even though it was breaking the restraining order, I did meet with him, and at that point he was having a little difficulty staying sober for long periods of time, but during his slivers of sobriety, I did make a formal verbal amends to him, and then I took care of what I consider to be my financial amend with him, and that was to basically take care of paperwork for his corporate bankruptcy as well as personal bankruptcy, because he had run his business into the ground, well, below the ground, by about $250,000. And because of the way he had structured the corporation, I was involved in that too, so that had to be straightened out. And I took care of all that. I paid for all the lawyers. I paid for everything, because I knew that he wasn't capable of doing that at that point. He couldn't either. He couldn't face it, was what he said. He just couldn't admit to himself or to anybody else that he had been that much of a failure. And I think that was one of the reasons why he just couldn't stay sober. Well, that was one of his reasons. You know, how we have our reasons. I continued to take care of that. I actually made another formal amends to him the morning that I picked him up from the VA. He was in another rehab. And I just sat down and I made my final verbal formal amends with him the morning that I took him with me to bankruptcy court. I understand since then he has gotten sober, and for that I'm very grateful, and I pray that he does stay sober. However, to my knowledge, he does not know where I live now. Um, And the restraining order went into the divorce decree, too. So, now let's see. Those to me were like really tough amends to make, because that was the beginning for me. And they were really big ones, too. And they were really involved, and there was a lot to them. Because it's always really hard, I think, when, you know, as my sponsor likes to say, you know, back in the beginning, my sponsor tells this story, and I really like it, because it kind of illustrates for me what my thinking was, even though it wasn't exactly how I was thinking, but it does illustrate for me the essence of it. And the essence of it is this, you know, even though I might forgive the person for what they did, you know, and then I might see my part in it, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll have this kind of like thinking about, you know, well, you know, if I kind of look at the whole situation and kind of break it up into fractions, you know, maybe like, you know, 2/3 of the stuff they did wrong and only like 1/3 of the stuff I did wrong, you know. So, you know, do I really have to go to them and talk to them, you know, because after all, you know, don't they owe me an amend too, you know? So, the problem is, though, that I really don't know what they're thinking. I don't know what they have to live with, but you know what? I have to live with what I have to live with. And I have to live with that third. And it's my third. And that's the essence of that, you know, ick that's still there when we take the alcohol away, you know? And if I don't get rid of the things that cause me to feel regret, to feel guilt, to feel remorse, even to feel, you know, complete depression over, you know, like, oh my God, how could I have done that kind of stuff? And look at what a horrible person I am. If I can't go to that person, you know, I have got to go to that person because, you know, eventually, someday, it's going to come back to bite me. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, I know alcoholics, you know, say in the room sometimes, you know, like it's not the big things that get us, it's the little things. But, you know, sometimes it's just because we don't give the big things enough credit, you know. And those are the big things, you know, those things that we have on our inventory that we look at and we see, you know, that relationship may never be right. I may never do lunch with that person again. But the fact of the matter is that they deserve for me to come to them and to talk to them and say, I regret that I acted this way, okay? Regardless of whether or not they remember it. And they also deserve to have their day in court, whatever that may be, you know, to, so to speak, you know, for me to say, is there something that I don't remember? Is there something that I haven't mentioned? Would you like to tell me how you feel about it? Is there anything I can do to set it right, you know? And barring things like my husband saying, well, you know, let's move back in together, I have to do what I, you know, the best I can to set the situation right. I made amends to each of my sisters. My sister Gail is the first one I made amends with. And when I went to make amends with her, there were a lot of things. What she had done to me when I was a kid, you know? And sometimes amends go that way, you know? Where, you know, I would say, you know, I said, this is what I did. I lied to you about this. I conned you about this. I used you for this, and, you know, I need to set the situation right. And, you know, there were specific actions that I had to do to set the situation right. And then I said, you know, is there anything you'd like to say, anything you want to tell me? And she started to say, well, you know, Joanne, when we were little children, because both of my sisters were older, I started to resent you even before you were born, you know? And that's where it started, you know? And she needed to tell me these things, you know? Now, the fact of the matter is that in a close relationship like that, I mean, this is somebody that I'm going to have lunch with a lot. I'm going to have Easter supper with her. I'm going to have Christmas morning with her. I'm going to have Christmas Eve church with her. You know, this is somebody that I'm going to see on a regular basis for the rest of my life. And it's funny because, you know, I look back at it now and I can remember the first couple years that I was sober. And every time the topic would come up about amends in a meeting, you know, I would always think about her because she was the one person who just wouldn't let it die. She just, you know, all of a sudden she just remembers something else that I did. And that's her little tone of voice right there, too. And, you know, Joanne, do you remember? And then she would go on, and I have to listen to it. And I need to look at her, and I need to, you know, I've learned in Buddhism to practice Tonglen, which is a breathing exercise. I use it a lot around my family. But our book tells us that, you know, we need to practice love and tolerance in all our affairs. You know, we need to look, love and tolerance is our code, it says. You know, that's what we have to do all day long, every day, and especially with our family. You know, because somehow they just know how to get you, you know? And my sister Gail just, and she's such an untreated codependent. You know? Not that we judge. Forgive me, Gail, when you hear this tape. But one of the things that I really have to, you know, I mean, it's amazing to me that as I go through inventory that there's certain people who pop up over and over and over again. And being an orphan, I don't know if anybody remembers last week, being an orphan, for me, it's my older sisters, especially my sister Gail, because she was closer to me in age and we had a closer relationship. And, for me, every time I do inventory, it just amazes me how she continuously falls short of my expectations. Now, who's that on? Me. That's the kind of stuff that I have to look at. And the beauty of this is that I can do that, you know, on a more moment-to-moment basis. You know, that kind of stuff doesn't really, you know, build up that much anymore. And you know, the fact of the matter is, I don't meet up to her expectations all the time either. And you know what? She really lets me have it. You know? There was one Christmas where, she put a lot of thought and effort into my Christmas gifts, and I just wasn't excited enough when I opened them. So about 10 days after Christmas, I got the phone call where, you know, she just kind of, you know, let me have it. And it went on for about a half an hour, and, you know, my boyfriend was at my house at the time, and one of the things that I need to do is just let her rant today, because she doesn't have this program, you know? And you know what? It amazes me how much better she's gotten the more I've done inventory. But she's not perfect yet, you know? So I just had to let her go. And for me, that's part of, you know, what they call like the living amend. And they talk a lot about it in, you know, the chapters about, you know, the family afterward and, to wives, which are really, you know, how do we live with our immediate family? How do we live in this world kind of stuff? And for me, you know, it's like, you know, I just had to let her go on. Now, you know, what she does, because she doesn't have this program and she can't bring herself to make a formal amend, is then for like another month after that, every time she called me, she was really, really, really sweet to me. And And I know that's how she makes her amends. And it's okay, you know? But these are the kinds of things that I need to understand, you know? When I made my amends with my other sister, Leslie, she's a little bit more on a spiritual beam. She's been doing... She actually was the one who, you know, when my husband first went into rehab, because his family did an intervention on him, my sister Leslie called me and started asking me all these questions about my drinking, and I was thinking to myself, you know, like, what has she been reading? You know, like, she was, like, asking me all these questions, like, she knew about alcoholism, you know? And she's been pretty much on a spiritual beam for quite a while now. You know, she's always been the one who sent me, like, even since when I was in my 20s, sent me, you know, spiritual books, you know, like, you know, you'll find them in the quote-unquote self-help section, but, you know, I love that. We're not going down that road right now, we don't have time. So, you know, she's really on a really spiritual beam. So when I made my amends with her, she just said to me, you know, Joanne, the past is the past, and we just have to go forward from here. And, you know, it was really nice, you know, because we kind of cried together and we knew that there was a lot of stuff that happened in both our pasts, you know, because we did grow up in the same family and a lot, and we're the product of the same experiences to a good degree, you know. She's not an alcoholic. In fact, she has like this really great wine collection, and they just don't drink it. You know, it's like it's an investment. You know, and it's very well taken care of and inventoried. I won't bring any sponsees to their house. Any new ones anyway. But that was one of those really nice amends, you know, where you just like feel really good afterwards, you know, like that was one of those ones where I really felt like, you know, our relationship kind of grew, you know. Not like it was an expectation, but it was just a byproduct. And I feel very, very easy talking to my sister, that sister, about spiritual matters. Because there's a lot of people in my life that, you know, who aren't in these rooms that I find it very difficult talking about this stuff with, because, you know, they just kind of go, uh-huh, yeah. Okay. So did you see Spider-Man? You know, that kind of stuff. I also made amends with my uncle who raised me. That was like a really formal amend. I made an appointment with him. He's in a nursing home. I hadn't seen him in a really long time. Because of my active alcoholism. And when I went to see him, I discovered that he's got Alzheimer's. And I think I was the first person in the family to really notice it, you know, because when I was talking with him, you know, and I brought him a big book and I showed him, you know, pictures of my home and what's going on with me today. And, you know, when I talked to him about, you know, my alcoholism, his response was, you know, we never did drink. We didn't have alcohol in our house, you know. And I said, I know. You know, and I was trying to explain to him about me being an alcoholic, and he really couldn't remember all these horrible things that I had done, you know, because, like, that was the household that I grew up in, where I didn't show up when I was supposed to show up, and I was an 18-year-old girl out all night, you know, from a nice family in a nice neighborhood, and that kind of stuff wasn't done. And all these things that, you know, I had so much guilt and remorse over for years and years and years and years. And these were the kinds of things that I really thought God was punishing me for, you know, when I first got here. And I found out that he didn't even remember them, you know. But I did. And the fact is that I took the steps and I went and I talked to him about it. And, you know, I go to visit him now. And we made a 90th birthday party for him last year, my sisters and I, you know, and that's one of the ways that, you know, I can make amends, because the family is so split apart by old grudges that I don't even know what they're about anymore. And actually at that birthday party, I'll just end with this one because I have 1 minute left. When I was growing up in my aunt and uncle's household, they had two older children, and one of them had children by the time we moved in and I was 7 years old. Those two sons never forgave us us kids, for our parents dying and us ruining their parents' lives. That's how it was put to me. And that was impressed upon me. Now, my aunt's grandchildren used to come to visit, and I would be their babysitter. And they did everything they could to get me in trouble. And it was easy for them because they were the grandchildren, and I was this, you know, kid that really didn't belong there. You know, I wasn't really a member of the household. And they used to always get me in trouble, and I despised them for that. And through the process of inventory, I was able to forgive them for that and forget. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about that process that happens between the third column and the fourth column, and the praying for the willingness to be able to make amends, is being able to forget so that I don't have to live with that remorse and that guilt and those hard feelings and that hardness of my heart today. Because one of these kids who's now 30-something and has her own three kids now came up to me at this 90th birthday party and apologized to me for what they had done when they were kids. And I looked at her completely blank, and it actually took a couple minutes for me to remember because I had forgotten about it. You know, and to me that's like one of the wonderful gifts of this whole process, is forgetting that stuff, you know? And so that was one of the results for me of this process. And it's just really, that for me was just such one of those like really big aha days, you know? Like, wow, you know? Like to have that in my face and to like, for me to actually stand before this woman and not remember what she was talking about. You know, to really have to search my memory. And she was, you know, she was coming to me to say she was sorry for all that stuff they had done when they were kids, you know. And it was really, really nice to have that experience and to be sober and to be, you know, part of that family that day. So thanks for letting me share.